This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. We also look at great peacemakers and peace moments from throughout history and today. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we spotlight two instances when peace broke out right on the field of battle. Later, we'll hear a report on a peace jubilee at the Manassas battlefield, scene of brutal engagements during the U.S. Civil War. One peace jubilee that took place in 1911 was commemorated on its 100th anniversary in 2011. But first, the impromptu but widespread unofficial Christmas truce of 1914, in the early months of fighting in Europe in World War I, when soldiers from both sides essentially said, "War is hell, let's not do it near Christmas Day." To tell us that story, we have Stanley Weintraub, historian, professor emeritus from Penn State University, biographer, and author of many books, including Silent Night, The Christmas Truce of 1914. He joins us from his home in Delaware. Dr. Weintraub, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
I know it's kind of basic history, but let's remind listeners of the where and the who of this event. Now, approaching Christmas time, 1914, describe the place and the principals assembled there.
There was war going on between Germany and Belgium, France, and England that was largely focused upon the area in Flanders, which is lowland close to the English Channel in the North Sea. Yet the fighting went on south all the way to Switzerland, several hundred miles of trench warfare at that point.
And opposing sides were often just yards apart, isn't that right?
They were often only yards apart, perhaps 75 yards apart, which isn't much when you think in terms of a football field being 100 yards. Therefore, they were very close. They were also very uncomfortable. The trenches filled with water. They put down wooden planks when they could. There were rats infesting the trenches. The rats fed on the dead. The dead were in what we called no man's land between the two sides. So the area between the two sides was close. It was also a terrible, smelly, awful mess.
It sounds like there was some fraternization from afar, in a way, between the sides in the weeks before Christmas.
Because they were so close, as we've been talking about, they could shout to each other. They could call each other names. They even got to know the first names of troops across the way. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England. They worked as barbers. They worked as wagon drivers and so on. And they knew English. And they were called back to Germany when the war began. So there, even if the English didn't know much German, the Germans knew a great deal of English.
About a week ahead of Christmas proper, according to these stories, there was a brief cooperative truce around a German trench concert. Can you tell that story?
The Germans, they wanted to have a concert, and they said, if you stop firing, you'll be able to listen to our concert. And the troops nearby, and of course this was one small sector, actually did so. But during the truce itself, it became such a spontaneous and widespread event that the Germans sent one member of the general staff, who was a singer in the Berlin Opera, out to sing Silent Night across the trenches. And the French, who claimed that they hated the Germans and wouldn't have any ceasefire of any sort, sent a tenor from the Paris Opera, and he sang O Holy Night, Cantique de Noël, across the trenches. So the idea of we can do better than you can do with Christmas songs, continued that business of music across the enemy lines.
Here's how that more friendly musical competition was portrayed in the film Joyeux Noël from 2005. In this adaptation, a Scottish bagpipe answers the German tenor.
Heiliger
Kunde macht durch der Engel hat. Tönt es laut vom
Splint! Kommen Sie da runter!
When the Germans began to actually light the candles on their little trees, the British wondered what it was, what was going on. And at a distance of 75 or 100 yards, they weren't sure. Some of them crept closer through the mud to see what was going on and discovered that the Germans were lighting their Christmas trees. The Germans, realizing that there were troops approaching them, crawled out too, and the troops met each other. This happened in many places along the front lines, especially in Flanders. The British did not have trees, but they had something else that they could show the Germans. I'm holding in my hand a brass box that says Christmas 1914, and it has the head of embossed head of Princess Mary, one of the daughter of King George V. The British actually sent over to the front lines hundreds of thousands of these brass boxes. Some of them were filled with candy. Some of them had tobacco. And there was a campaign to get these to the troops. When the Germans discovered that the British were doing this, they quickly began to fabricate wooden boxes with sausages and cigars and so on. And both sides, it seemed, as they crawled out to meet each other, had things to trade. And so there was a swapping of Christmas gifts. And this was not expected. No one thought that when you sent something for your own troops' morale, they would use it to swap. But these little boxes did do this. And when they got together in no man's land on Christmas Eve, they were not only in mucky territory, but there were shell holes and there were bodies. And they began to think in terms of burying the dead. That if they buried the dead, they might be able to get together the next day and not only do that, but perhaps trade gifts, and some of them said, and play football, football meaning our soccer. And they did. And this was one of the things that, when I was working on the earlier book on the armistice, had been considered absolutely absurd. They couldn't possibly have played football in such circumstances and in such terrain. And yet I found in the Imperial War Museum and in German documents, war diaries, that is official documents, the daily reports, that not only talked about the football games, but gave the scores.
The scores corroborated each other in many senses, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Yeah. And the result was that more and more of what had been called a myth turned out to be reality.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're recalling a rare moment in the history of warfare when troops from opposing sides, drawn by their curiosity of each other and a lack of will to fight on through Christmas, began to fraternize with their adversaries. In this case, in Flanders Field during December 1914 in World War I. Historian and author of the book Silent Night, The Story of the Christmas Truce of 1914, Stanley Weintraub, is telling us the tale. And Dr. Weintraub, you unearthed many letters and artifacts proving this rather widespread fraternizing. And I'm wondering if you would, for us, read this one letter that you quoted starting on page 83.
This is a British officer writing. More Germans had emerged between the lines, and he wrote, "Things were getting a bit thick. My men were getting a bit excited. We didn't like to fire, as they were all unarmed. But we had strict orders, and someone might have fired. so I climbed over the parapet and shouted my best German for the opposing captain to appear. We met and formally saluted. He introduced himself as Count something or other, and seemed a very decent fellow. He could not talk a word of English. He then called one of his subalterns and formally introduced them with much clicking of heels and saluting. They were all very well turned out, while I was in a goatskin coat. One of the subalterns could talk a few words of English. I said, "My orders are to keep my men in the trenches and allow no armistice. Don't you think it is dangerous, all of your men running about in the open like this? Someone may open fire." He called out an order, and all his men went back to their parapet, leaving me and the five German officers and a barrel of beer in the middle of no man's land. He said, "You better take the beer. We have lots." So I called up two men to bring the barrel to our side. I didn't like to take their beer without giving something in exchange, and suddenly I had a brainwave. We had lots of plum puddings, so I sent for one and formally presented it to him in exchange for the beer. He then called out, "Waiter," and a German private whipped out six glasses and two bottles of beer, and with much bowing and saluting we solemnly drank it, and cheers from both sides. Then we all formally saluted and returned to our lines. Our men had sing-songs, ditto the enemy. So this is one example of how fraternization began and the truce continued.
Hello, Tommy.
Tommy was the nickname the Germans had for the English soldiers. Here, another dramatization of the troops meeting up in the film Oh, What a Lovely War.
Alles gut, ja?
Oh, ja, ja.
Jetzt trinken wir Schnaps. Well, bloody time, too.
That's good stuff, Jerry.
Hey, thank you very much.
Bitte schön.
Fritz.
Huh. How are you, Fritz?
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. How's the Kaiser?
How are your trenches?
Terrible. Not fit for pigs. When it rains, we're up to our knees in mud and water.
Aren't you sick of the war?
Before the war, I was staying in Suffolk. And I left there a 3 1/2 horsepower motorcycle.
And also a girl.
Hey, do you hear that? This chap's got a girlfriend in Suffolk.
We will not ever shoot again. Unless you start.
Do you hear that?
That'll suit us, man, I can tell you. Here, we'll drink to that. That is Scottish schnapps.
This is your guns that are shooting?
No. It's a bastard English. No us.
They will not shoot at us while you are here.
Don't believe that, man. It's us they're shooting at.
Oh, well. Thanks very much, mate, and give my love to the comment.
A clip from the film Oh, What a Lovely War, a 1969 adaptation of a 1963 British stage play. So how long did it go on, and how did it come to an end?
It went on in some places just through Christmas. It depended on the area involved and how close the people were and how pressured they felt by commanding officers to the rear. What is interesting, and the point is made very well in film and the play, Oh, What a Lovely War, is that senior officers seldom ventured toward the front lines. So that meant that the troops could do pretty much what they wanted. But when reports came back to the fancy chateaus in the rear where the generals were stationed, they complained about it and they issued orders that this had to stop. And it stopped as soon as they sent replacements out to take the places of the troops that had fraternized.
And from your standpoint, Dr. Weintraub, why do you think this story resonates so well and so closely with people now, almost 100 years later?
I think it resonates because we yearn for a time when there is greater peace than we have, a time when every day, as the poet said, will be like Christmas Day, a day when families get together, when there's camaraderie, when there's friendliness, when hatred vanishes. It's a utopian idea, a utopian vision, but we all long for it. When we get close enough, we realize that on both ends of the rifle, we're the same. The trouble is that we or at least governments, never learn from history. the lesson of the Christmas truce has vanished, as all truces vanish this way, because peace is harder to make than war.
Dr. Stanley Weintraub taught many, many years at Penn State and is also the author of many fine books, including the 2001-2002 book, Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Stanley Weintraub, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, with all of our episodes to hear online at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Now to the story of another war and a peacemaking wound-healing event that happened 50 years after its end. In late April of 1865, the American Civil War was not entirely finished, even though Robert E. Lee had surrendered at Appomattox and President Lincoln had been assassinated in Washington. Tens of thousands of Union and Confederate troops in North Carolina stood ready to keep on fighting if the final negotiations between their own commanders failed. Among the war-weary Southern soldiers camped in Greensboro, North Carolina, was a young signal corpsman named David Hamilton Russell. To the east in Raleigh, a Northern Signal Corps lieutenant, George Carr Round, manned an observation post atop the state capitol building. Round, like Russell, had been a soldier since the war began, and he prayed that he would soon hear that the Confederate General Joseph Johnston and Union General William Sherman had come to terms. When that news arrived at last, on the night of April 26th, Round sent what's known as the last signal message of the Civil War, launching color-coded rockets from the Capitol Dome in Raleigh to spell out, "Peace on Earth, goodwill to men." Half a century later, in 1911, Round and Russell's life stories converged again. The result of that was the National Jubilee of Peace, the first major gathering of Civil War veterans from both sides. Steve Pendlebury has our story from the place where it happened in 1911 and was reenacted in the summer of 2011. He spoke with the reenactment planners in Manassas, Virginia.
Reenactors don't always like it when I say it, but I've said for years, you know, why do we reenact the war when it's the peace that's so much more interesting, exciting, and ultimately beneficial to our children and for the generations to come?
That's Ken Elston, the chairman of the George Mason University Theater Department. He wrote and directed a dramatization of the Peace Jubilee for the city of Manassas.
It's a far-reaching sort of epic outdoor piece that is, you know, part theater, part spectacle, part halftime show.
Elston's historical theater troupe Footsteps in Time recreated the unprecedented reunion of veterans from North and South who came together in Manassas on July 21, 1911 for a celebration of peace and national unity, 50 years to the day after the first major land battle of the Civil War.
With the possible exception of the Persian Wars, this is the first time in recorded history that former enemies met on the same battlefield where they once met in mortal combat to affirm peace. And that's pretty exciting. When you look at the history of the world, the U.S. is unique for a lot of reasons. One of those reasons is that we had this terrible four-year struggle of the American Civil War and came out of it a stronger nation. You know, I'm from Philadelphia, and in Philadelphia we always celebrate the birth of the nation, 1776. And it seems to me that here in Manassas, Virginia, we celebrate the rebirth of the nation.
I think one of the stories that is, you know, sometimes lost at Manassas, because the battle being the first battle grabs the nation's attention, is this story of reconciliation.
It's a story Manassas National Battlefield Park Superintendent Ed Clark doesn't get to tell as often as he'd like.
Both sides taking up, you know, their previous positions and marching across the field, instead of this time not in anger and not with bloodshed on their mind, but with peace and reconciliation in their mind. And instead of meeting with arms, they met with handshakes.
More about how the 1911 Peace Jubilee came to be in a few moments. But first, to appreciate how extraordinary the event was, you have to understand what happened during the First Battle of Manassas, or Bull Run as it's also known, 50 years earlier.
At the beginning of the Civil War, you know, after Lincoln is elected and Fort Sumter occurs and he calls all of the troops, there was, I think, great excitement, both in the North and the South, for what was coming. They ended up meeting here as they say it at the time, on the plains of Manassas. And what both sides endured that day, on that July 21st day, shocked the nation.
Families brought their children and their picnic lunches from as far away as D.C. to sit and watch the spectacle of overwhelming force from the north taking on the ragged band from the south, or the plantation owners here believing that the show of southern pride and dedication to state and this new idea of the new Confederate States of America would overwhelm the forces of the Union. Certainly no one believed in their heart of hearts, at least these people with their picnic lunches, that Americans would be killing Americans right in front of their eyes.
George Carr Round, the Union officer who proclaimed peace with his signal rockets in Raleigh at the end of the war, was not at the First Battle of Manassas, although he too was profoundly affected by his experiences throughout the conflict. He was stationed in Manassas for a while later in the war to defend the Strategic Railroad Junction. Round became a lawyer in New York and returned to settle in Manassas in 1868. Although some of the locals dismissed him as a carpetbagger at first, Round became a pillar of the community.
He named the streets. So we're at the corner of Grant and Lee. We're at the corner of Grant and Lee so that they would forever meet in peaceful accord. That was very important to him.
The inscription on his tombstone at Arlington National Cemetery hails Round as the originator of the Peace Jubilee. But the idea for the event actually came from D.H. Russell, who was among the last Confederate troops to surrender in Greensboro. Russell was wounded at First Manassas, and after the war, he became a newspaper editor and civic leader in Anderson, South Carolina. On January 2, 1911, Russell wrote a letter to the editor of the Washington Post. Bob Root reads from that letter.
The 21st day of next July will be the 50th anniversary of the First Battle of Manassas, and it has occurred to me that it would be a gracious thing, and tending to promote peace and good feeling, if Congress would make an appropriation to bring together in a national encampment on that celebrated field the survivors of both armies who actually participated in the battle. It would be a spectacle that could not take place in any other country on the globe and would have a good effect in promoting the rising tide of peace and goodwill that seems to be prevailing over the country and in wiping out any remaining animosities. What do you think of it?
George Round thought it was a great idea. And it was the old veteran, not Congress, who turned it into a reality just half a year after reading Russell's letter in the newspaper. A remarkable feat, says Ed Clark.
He pulled all of these people together, and if you think about trying to get, you know, in rural Virginia at that time, this many people to transport that far, to get that message out that far, to coordinate all of that, it must have taken a tremendous amount of effort and energy.
Hundreds of veterans gathered on the hilltop where the tide of the battle had turned, where Confederate General Stonewall Jackson earned his nickname, and where the blood-curdling rebel yell was heard for the first time. This time, the former foes embraced. They shared a picnic lunch. Then they headed to the courthouse in town to see the President of the United States, William Howard Taft.
America, we look to thee with thanks to those who made us free. North, south, east, west,
look at the Civil War, it's difficult to celebrate. You can commemorate, you can keep memories alive, you can talk about the stories that weave together, but you can't really celebrate such a bloody war. You can celebrate the Peace Jubilee. You can celebrate people coming together and those veterans meeting again in their dotage to hold hands, to put their arms around each other, to stand around a campfire, which they did here on the lawn. We're sitting in the courthouse in Manassas City now, where the event happened in 1911, and the lawn was dotted with campfires for an entire week as the veterans didn't leave this property, and they told stories, and they laughed, and they sang, and they really had a jubilee.
Colonel Berkeley, you live in Virginia all your life?
Heck no. Not yet, anyway.
We have been remembering those bygone days today, and Manassas has offered us so many fond memories to carry on with us forever.
Fond memories. The last time I was down here, my tent leaked something awful.
Well, didn't you fix it?
Couldn't fix it in the rain.
Well, why didn't you fix it when the sun was shining?
It didn't leak then.
You know, we have this dance among the people. We have these scenarios among this crowd. We have the President of the United States coming down Grant Avenue in his car, being led by children of the community.
I think it's so iconic to have President Taft, the United States President, on the stage with the last Virginia governor who had served in the Confederacy on that stage together.
As promised, folks, the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, when we look back on that period of 50 years ago, a feeling of sadness must overcome us. For that is a period we dislike to look back upon. A period of sorrow and discouragement, reviving in our minds all the strain and trial of that awful struggle. I do not know if it might have been achieved in some more peaceful way. I do not know if we could have found an alternate path. But I do know that in that struggle, each side showed a strength which neither side had known that it possessed, developed a strength of character before the entire world, that the world had never witnessed before. It is my greatest ambition as President of these United States to do everything sensible and everything reasonably possible to bring the two sections of this country even closer together, if such be possible. To make them feel in the South, as well as in the North, that the Supreme Court of the United States is their Supreme Court. The Congress, their Congress. The President of the United States, their President.
I think it's so important at these times, at these, you know, milestones, these markers in history, to recall these events and remind America of places we have been and great things we have done.
I would love to be able to say that there was actual, lasting attention to this idea of peace and love and unity, and that we as a community put that on our shoulders as what we would model for the rest of the world. And I'm afraid that we as a society and as a people and as a race and a species maybe haven't yet come to that particular place in our lives yet.
For Peace Talks Radio, I'm Steve Pendlebury.
You can find links to more information about the Peace Jubilee celebration of both 1911 and its commemoration in 2011 at our website, peacetalksradio.com, where you can also find more about the World War I Christmas Truce of 1914, which we talked about earlier with author Stanley Weintraub, all at peacetalksradio.com. That's also where you can hear an hour-long version of this program with much more from our guests. And peacetalksradio.com is where you can hear all the programs in our series going back to 2003, order CDs of most episodes, sign up for a podcast and our newsletter, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program independently from your local public radio station. Please consider a donation. It really will help. For more frequent updates and inspiration, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the F&S Fund of the Santa Fe Community Foundation, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Special thanks to Steve Pendlebury, too, for years of support of all kinds, and for today's report on the Manassas Peace Jubilee. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. I'm Paul Ingles. Thank you for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.